Well, hello everyone. My name is Nicholas Tamasevich, and I am the Director of Research and Academic Affairs here at KEI. It is my pleasure to welcome you to KEI for our Academic Paper Series event today on Preparing for Change in North Korea, Shifting Out of Neutral. For those of you who are new here today, I just want to briefly describe our Academic Paper Series. Every year we commission about 10 papers on unique topics of timely interest related to Korea issues. We publish each paper individually, and today's paper will be online shortly. At the end of the year, we will put all the individual papers together and publish them in a volume called On Korea. Our On Korea volume with the 2010 papers has just been published, and this nice copy has been placed on your chairs, so feel free to go through those after today's event. Turning to today's paper and event, we have an important topic on the possible futures for North Korea. Many of us Korea and Asia watchers are focusing on the possible futures for the Korean Peninsula and Northeast Asia in 2012. But we are fortunate to have this paper to help us examine other scenarios for the peninsula. And it is my pleasure to introduce our speaker for today, who will present this paper, Dr. Michael Mazar. Dr. Mazar will talk about the paper, and then we'll open up for questions from the audience. I know you have his bio, but allow me to mention some of the key highlights. Dr. Mazar is Professor of National Security Strategy and the Associate Dean for Research and Outreach at the U.S. National War College here in Washington, D.C. He is also the Project Director for the Study Group on North Korean Futures, and Dr. Mazar and the study group wrote today's paper. He has been President of the Henry L. Stimson Center and worked at CSIS. He has experience working on Capitol Hill, and he was the Special Assistant to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from December 2008 to January 2010. He served in the U.S. Navy Reserve, and he has authored 10 books, including one entitled North Korea and the Bomb. And most importantly, Dr. Mazar was one of the authors of our inaugural academic paper series, an On Korea volume. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Michael Mazar. Dr. Mazar.
Thank you very much, Nicholas, and thank you all very much for coming out today. It's a great pleasure to be with you, and on behalf of the study group, we appreciate your sharing some of your very precious time with us. It's a great pleasure to be here with a truly expert audience, and we look forward not only to your questions, but to your thoughts and comments on this significant issue. I want to thank also the Korea Economic Institute for their help in organizing this event today, for publishing our humble study as one of their academic paper series, which is one of the finest series of scholarly outputs on Korea. It's always an honor to be at KEI, and to Ambassador Pritchard, to Abe, to Nicholas, thank you very much for hosting us here today. It's a great honor to be here. I do need to start with a couple of disclaimers. All of our comments here today, myself and the group, will reflect our personal opinions only. Not those of the U.S. government, the Defense Department, the National Defense University, our mother, our father, anyone else except for ourselves. The same with the report. As the disclaimer in the report indicates, this is, of course, a report that reflects the views of the individuals in the group and not that of the U.S. government. Now, I'm going to open up today as a convenience because we need someone to give you the basic outlines of what the report argues. But this is absolutely a collective effort. The report is the product of a study group, and the analysis in the report and the specific arguments and ideas and even sentences are the result of the entire group that has come today. Senior professionals who are assigned to the U.S. National Defense University, the National War College, the Industrial College of the Armed Forces, and the College of International Security Affairs, and they're here in the front row. And when we get to the question and answer period, as questions come in, I'll refer some of your questions to members of the group for them to answer as well. The group is Claudius Bubner, Eric Manisi, Brent Sadler, Rob Brem, Lourdes Talbot, Greg Gagnon, and Mooney Che. And so as we get to the question and answer period, you'll hear from all of them as well as from me. Okay. So our analysis as we approach this subject, and what we did was we basically took half a year, the last half of 2010, did a wide variety of research, talked to a number of experts, and put together the report out of that effort. It stemmed from two basic insights. First of all, North Korean regime futures, by which term we meant the whole basket of issues that you can imagine, instability, collapse, the future of the regime after Kim Jong-il. That issue was coming at us at an accelerating pace. And secondly, U.S. and allied policy remained focused almost exclusively on the nuclear issue and had not yet evolved a coherent strategy for this second looming challenge in policy regarding North Korea. So that's the basic notion that we want to engage with you here today, that we try to engage in the paper, that if regime futures is a key issue, and if we are not yet adequately postured to respond, and by we meant primarily the United States, but also allies, South Korea, Japan, and even other nations, then what do we do about it? And that was the basic analytical challenge that we posed to ourselves in the report. Over time, we decided, in the course of our analysis, the challenge of regime futures is likely to become as important to the United States as even the nuclear question. Our view is not that the United States should at all abandon denuclearization as a policy priority, but that emphasis in our policy needs to complement and expand beyond nuclear issues with much more energetic, elaborate, and strategic concepts for dealing with this basket of issues that we called regime futures. So that was really the main purpose of our study, to spark, if we could, more thinking, more analysis among expert groups like this within the U.S. government and elsewhere about this policy challenge before it emerges and before policymakers are left sort of groping their way, improvising their way through crises that have emerged without strategic thought being done in advance. Now, there are a lot of specific elements to the report. I won't go through them in detail. You've got the report. You can read it. I'll offer a few highlights to kind of spark the discussion, and then we can take it from there in question and answer. We lay out a number of our basic goals we're trying to achieve with the report, some of our basic assumptions, U.S. interests at stake in Korea. A lot of those will be very familiar to an audience like this. We examine a number of specific scenarios that could emerge in the future of North Korea and potential risks that would come from those in policy for the United States. Our focus as we did our analysis was particularly on regime futures. We weren't trying to develop a broad-based approach toward North Korea, but look at the challenges of regime futures and policies designed to address that in particular, and what we could do to develop a stronger posture on that issue. Now, in practice, focusing in particular on that slice of policy proved somewhat difficult, as you can imagine, because all these things are interlinked with one another. In particular, broader U.S. approaches toward North Korea, the broad policy challenge, is very much bound up with anything that we could think of in regard to the challenge of regime futures and what we might do about it. As an example, one of the initial conclusions that we made, which was part of a lot of our initial assumptions, was that the major interests of the United States and North Korea are fundamentally opposed, and a stable relationship over time is not likely. So a logical conclusion was that U.S. and allied problems stem from the nature of the North Korean regime. There will be no permanent negotiated settlement to denuclearization, the recurrent provocations or crises that North Korea sparks, human rights issues, other kinds of things, unless or until the nature of the regime changes. Now, it's a pretty straightforward observation, but one implication of it is that our long-standing approach of offering North Korea a fundamental choice in the hope that it will someday see that its best interests lie in a radical shift toward denuclearization, economic reform, other changes, joining the globalizing world community, that this policy has little chance of success, if this basic assumption is true. If you don't have radical change in the regime, North Korea's political and strategic interests mitigate against the kind of choice that we are offering to it, and the policy that we are adopting is not likely to succeed. We also concluded that there are risks that are not widely appreciated to the current approach of waiting on North Korea, of laying out this kind of an offer, putting sanctions on the regime, and then waiting in the hope that, or in the expectation that eventually they will have to make this choice. And we lay out some of those risks in the report, risks that it forces North Korea to engage in provocations to get our attention. There may be WMD leakage, more time for China to acquire influence, other kinds of risks in the current policy that we call strategic patience or other terms that are used. So some of the assumptions that we made in terms of even the issue we were looking at have broad implications for policy. So specifically, how do we approach the issue of regime futures? The overriding insight that we came to in our analysis that kind of drove our conclusions was the idea that, as many of you have studied in detail, many of you appreciate, the North Korea of today is not the North Korea of 10 years or 20 years ago, that changes in awareness and economic realities, changes in economic structure, social structure in North Korea, have created a North Korea that is very different on the ground, even in terms of governance and the role that the state plays in the lives of citizens, where the dominant role of the state is giving way to some extent to this market-based mentality, where individual will, the market, the role of the market, self-promotion, profit-making have become leading values. And our argument is that this offers an avenue of potential leverage for outside powers who want to achieve their interests within North Korea. What examples are we talking about? The decline of the public distribution system and the implications of that for the mentality of individuals as they look at the role of the government in their lives. The marketization of public lives, the role of the markets you know very well, but not only the dependence of people on those for their well-being, but also, again, the change in psychology of people as they become, as markets become ingrained in the way that people conduct their daily life, the rise of a new market-based elite, and the role of people who have become more wealthy, more powerful, had a larger social role because of the way that they've become engaged in markets and selling in markets, everything from individuals getting small local operations going to poorly understood but widely reported individuals who become middlemen in selling in the market, the empowerment of those connected with the royal court economy and its international trading activities, the explosion of sources of information inside North Korea, a phenomenon well understood by those in this room. So all these things together create a North Korea whose society is in some degree of transformation, admittedly not entirely understood, but absolutely ongoing, and a process, no question, that the regime in North Korea is doing a lot to try to control, to reverse, to undermine, but a basic trend that we think is still very much underway. So our overriding recommendation is to seize these trends, to take advantage of them, to take the initiative away from North Korea rather than having a passive policy, and to use these trends to our advantage in the context of a policy that approaches regime futures. Two related analytical points. One is relates to the balance of influence between external and internal factors. Coercion-based strategies that we've typically used have tended to assume that change in North Korea will come from external pressure to generate behavioral change on the part of the regime. But our analysis suggests that, in part, for example, because of the conflicting interests of regional powers, who don't always agree on what kind of change they want, on the degree of coercion that will be applied, and because of these changing dynamics inside North Korea, our argument is that change in North Korea is more likely in coming years to come from internal forces rather than external coercion. Changing social patterns, growing alternative sources of power, fracturing among elites, a variety of internal sources. North Korea, we argue, is becoming composed of actors with different interests and goals, a trend that will shape regime outcomes and that offers leverage for our policy. But we continue to see North Korea as a monolith and trying to leverage from the outside. So we argue for a fundamental change in strategy in this way. Second related analytical point is the growing influence of China within North Korea. Now, China's influence is often exaggerated, as everyone in this room probably knows. But the longer that we work to isolate North Korea, we meaning the United States, South Korea, Japan, the more we create a circumstance in which the only actor energetically working within North Korea, economically, socially to some extent, on a large scale is China. And that could create potential problems. One is that large-scale investment, buying up of mineral rights and so on is being done solely by China, so that after a regime change moment, it creates significant complications. But perhaps even more than that, we argue that as U.S. frustration with North Korea rises, U.S. frustration with China because of this relationship also rises. And we think that we don't sufficiently appreciate North Korea as a subset of U.S.-China relations and the potential for flashpoints there. So we offer three main recommendations. Two focused on preparing in a planning sense for regime future scenarios, and one on active measures to shape regime futures. These recommendations are designed to achieve some very specific goals, goals we lay out in the report. You can read them there. They range from acquiring better information about North Korea to preparing for these scenarios to actually shaping what's going on in North Korea. The first broad set of recommendations is what we call addressing hard questions. This is pretty straightforward. We argue for creating a more established mechanism in the U.S. government and eventually multilaterally to just address difficult questions. And the list of questions we have in the report is just an initial set. We know that it's sort of suggestive and that ultimately in a policy setting it would grow and change. But the idea is that there are key questions that have not yet been answered and in many cases not yet been asked, so that when a crisis comes, policymakers will be groping for answers rather than have good answers, potential answers, or options prepared for them. Questions like, once a collapse begins, is it U.S. policy that the North Korean regime must end? If China were to intervene to prop up the regime in the case of a potential instability moment, what would be our policy toward that? These kinds of questions. So we recommend more attention to those. Second broad set of recommendations. Going beyond thinking about questions to developing concrete mutual understandings and even agreements. As of today, neither the U.S. nor the surrounding powers has any clear established criteria to guide their reactions in the case of a regime futures event. And this recommendation would move into the realm of active planning and diplomatic dialogue on a number of issues, say advanced notifications and agreements on issues like humanitarian response, WMD control, mutual reassurance on military movements in time of crisis, those sorts of things, discussions on post-scenario issues of borders and sovereignty, creation of a track 2 or track 1.5 dialogue to get recommendations on these things, give them to governments. Now, quite obviously, these things are politically sensitive, actually in both of these first two categories, and to some extent, that's held up more active discussion of these issues. One of our conclusions in the report is that because of the significance of these issues and the danger of not having them worked out in advance, the political sensitivity should no longer hold up active discussion of them. There's no question that if the United States were to move into active discussion of these and if there were a multilateral discussion of some of these issues, that would not make North Korea happy. They would not feel comfortable about their future being discussed in these ways. But again, preparedness is essential. And our argument is that that is a key value. The third and final set of recommendations is what we call an active posture to invest in trends inside North Korea. And this is where we get into ideas to try to take advantage of these trends going on inside the North, to prepare for regime futures while seizing the strategic initiative and holding it and achieving, trying to achieve our interest in North Korea. The way we describe it is active support for social, informational, and economic trends inside North Korea to enhance our knowledge and influence and to prepare for fundamental change. What do we mean by that? We give a number of specific ideas in the report, with the caveat that we know these are just suggestive notions. The details could be worked out, you know, later in policy discussions, but we're trying to get the initial idea on the table that this broad direction would promote U.S. and allied interests. But some of the examples we offer include enhanced communication and contact with North Korean officials, targeted development assistance, capacity building programs aimed at specific sectors and North Korean officials and academics, expanding efforts to spread information inside North Korea, say expanded funding for radio stations, encourage and promote private enterprise foreign direct investment, and some others. Now, we know that the current moment is not supportive of some of these ideas. One of the things we do in the report is try to lay out a two-phase approach where, given some of North Korea's recent provocations and their nuclear behavior, some of these things, say, for example, development assistance, just is not going to fly in the current environment. So we try to divide up things that could be done immediately and some things that would have to wait for at least some progress, some breakthrough on the nuclear issue, recognizing that you're going to need some progress to get some of this done. And even beyond that, we know that there are risks and challenges with this kind of an approach. North Korea, obviously, has a very deliberate history of putting rigid controls on a lot of what goes on inside its borders. How much are we really going to be able to achieve with some of these programs? What limits are they going to put on them? How many North Korean officials, how many North Korean experts are we going to be able to reach? To what effect? There is a risk of accelerating some of the regime change scenarios. If we reach more North Koreans with more information, if we put more investment in, if more North Koreans get more knowledge about the outside world, could that make a regime change scenario happen more quickly? And are there some actors that wouldn't want that actually to happen? And finally, we're well aware that there is an inherently paradoxical character to this kind of overall initiative that we're offering. On the one hand, we are offering North Korea some forms of benefit, investment, aid, training. On the other hand, there are aspects of what we're doing, flooding more information in, contact with their officials that they would consider threatening. The broad sort of theme by which we're offering this, which is promoting our interests in North Korea that they would consider threatening. The overall approach is inherently paradoxical. We consider that to be an advantage, not a disadvantage, from our interests. But it makes the policy possibly difficult to explain. It means that the policy is going to be perceived by certainly many North Koreans as threatening. It means that there are aspects of it that they might reject out of hand because of that. It makes it challenging. We still believe that overall, it's a policy that promotes our interests in regard to the issue of regime futures. Our basic idea is that the current approach of lack of contact, continued sanctions, and indifferent preparedness for regime futures is not getting us anywhere. And in particular, as I said at the beginning, adding this as a second lead priority or another lead priority to U.S. policy toward North Korea is an urgent priority for the United States and its allies. That's the main message we're trying to get across. And if we can help to, with others who are thinking that way, to spark a dialogue on that, we will have achieved our purpose. So I'll stop there. We'll take questions. And the group as a whole will help me answer them. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Mazar. We'll now open up to questions. So we have microphones, so please wait for the microphones. If you can, please state your name and your affiliation, and please ask the question. So, questions from the audience? Chris Nelson, please start us off. Microphone here for you.
Thanks, Nick. Thanks, Dr. Mazar. God, it's hard to listen to that and not say, damn, I agree with every single word of it. What is there to talk about? But obviously, as you point out, there are certain policy constraints that are in place, not least of which is being in some ways, an increasingly hostile congressional attitude, given the change of power in the House. Even if the heavens opened up, getting the money out of House Foreign Affairs would be an interesting debate. So, my question is: when you look at the impediments, what's your sense of when something could get going? Given the North Korean focus towards what they're trying to do in 2012 and what seems to be still a very strong sense of benign neglect is the way to go here. Are we looking years down the road or what? Yep. In the meantime, ugh. Yeah.
Right,
anyway,
right.
Thank you.
Yep. Somebody from the group want to take a shot at that? Rob?
Hello? Yeah, I'll start off, but I think it gets back to the unknowability. Could be early or could be late, but by attempting to make a predictive approach, as we've often done, the imminent collapse of the past and those kinds of suggestions, I think it's very difficult to put a time horizon on it. And again, that makes it difficult to approach policymakers on that because they wanted that definite timeline. But the key is to be prepared as much as you can for whenever that event occurs, whether it happens earlier or later, but without trying to pin a specific timeline on it.
Okay. And the other thing I would say about it is, in the report we do, like I said, we sort of break out toward the end a particular list of things we think could be started immediately. Some of the issues of efforts to contact North Korean officials, overt and covert activities in that regard, and a variety of other kinds of things that don't appear to be helping the regime, don't rely on a lot of money. It's a smaller list of things you could start right away, and certainly all the planning things, certainly all the things in the first two categories. So you've got the first two categories and then a beginning set of relatively small initiatives that that start to, and there's some specific initiatives in there about working with the defector community in South Korea, training and planning and things like that, and getting more information into North Korea. So it's a smaller list, but there are some things that, and if you begin to get that mindset going, and sort of get people thinking that that promotes our interests, at least it's a start.
Other questions? We'll go right here in the middle. Gentleman right here.
Hi, thank you. Changzhu is Legal Daily China. I have two questions. First, we've been hoping for a change from Pyongyang for many years, but there are some people suggesting that we should seek for policy change rather than regime change. And from what you recommended in the paper, that we need to engage with the middle class, with North Korea and the high level of the regime, it seems to me also it's a kind of a policy change. So could you elaborate more? What is regime change? Secondly, you mentioned that there's some ground in North Korea. There's some ground for social or political transformation. I just wonder, is this ground strong enough that to trigger kind of a dramatic change like what we've been seeing in Middle East like that? Thank you.
Okay. Anybody have a thought on either of those?
The question, I'm sure if this is on, but can you hear me? Okay. The question of regime change is change to what? The U.S. interest is a regime that would denuclearize North Korean capability. So there's no agreement that anyone who would come to power would actually make that policy choice in Pyongyang. What we've seen from North Korea is actually their use of the nuclear deterrent effectively to mitigate a South Korean qualitative advantage militarily, whether that's the ROK Air Force or the ROK Army. So North Korea, for regime survival, whether it's the current regime or the next, requires a nuclear deterrent. That is only reinforced by recent U.S. behavior, whether it be the invasion of Iraq or the recent military action in Libya. KCNA, about 2 weeks ago, put out a public statement that Libya's big mistake was giving up their nuclear program. So we're in sort of this cycle of reinforcing truths to the North Koreans. One of our challenges with Beijing is that we don't see a common end game. America's current policy is a new regime that denuclearizes, and that is our priority. In Beijing, the priority is a stable North Korea, which may have the same regime or may have a different regime that still keeps their nuclear capability.
And of course, as we say in the report, you know, all parties in the region talk about a peaceful, unified Korea as their ultimate goal. And so whether, you know, is by definition, does that meet your definition of regime change? One of the things we early on in this report ran into was this problem of terminology and you know, collapse, instability, regime, all those sort of things are loaded terms that almost promote more misunderstanding than understanding because different people understand them in different ways. And so from our standpoint, I think, as Greg is implying, our recommendations are almost, you know, agnostic or non-committal on what you would traditionally think of as regime change. You know, we lay out the U.S. interests in the region, and they include stability, they include the peaceful unification of all the things that we traditionally understand. And then we talk about the risks inherent in the scenarios that could emerge as North Korea moves toward its regime futures. And then we lay out policies designed to mitigate those risks. That's how we approach this analytical problem, without trying to think about it in the terminology of that sort of thing. Do you want to add something, Rob?
I was just going to comment on the second question a bit on the grassroots issue. Some of the discussions we had was, do the the degree of the atomization of the society and how it's separated politically, geographically, due to the infrastructure issues, the lack of information, things like that. So direct comparisons, I think, to what's going on in the Middle East is challenging, which is, again, why we look at the where the influences influencers potentially are in the middle and perhaps eventually lower elite structures that have direct influence over the lives of the people at some point in time in the future is probably where the target that we were kind of looking at. One, it limits the points of access that we have to gain entry to, and two, it recognizes the atomization of the society.
Mm-hmm. All right, other questions? Yes, Karen Lee right here.
Thank you for your good report. I have three questions. The first is that very often the response from the administration to a particular proposal or suggestion is, if we do that, such and such, we are thereby recognizing North Korea as a nuclear weapons state, and we can't do that. So I'd like you to address that as a barrier. Number two is you suggest withholding new high-level official bilateral dialogue until conditions ripen. I'm curious about why you would withhold that, and what is your definition of ripen in that for that particular proposal. And number three is you've talked about the fact that China and the U.S. don't have a common end game as a problem, not just in dealing with the DPRK, but as a real problem for U.S.-China relations, and yet I didn't hear or see a recommendation on trying to develop more convergence in a U.S.-Chinese approach. So if you could comment on that. Thank you.
Okay. Brent, you want to tackle one of those?
Just on the first question about the de facto recognition of North Korea as a nuclear power, the key thing in the strategy is the insistence on the six-party talks and the one aspect, the 2005 statement, to try and hold that commitment. And any other type of recognition engagement would have to be done very carefully so that we don't, overtly recognize North Korea as a nuclear power equal. That's the six-party, that statement that's in the strategy about the six-party talks is to hold them to that statement, not necessarily if they have to restate it. I think I speak for the group on that. The six-party talks, we saw that as the one tangible benefit to maintain the six-party talks, and we didn't really see much else in addition to that.
Yeah, I think it's definitely something we, struggled with because one of our primary assumptions in the report is that North Korea will not give up its nuclear weapons, basically the current regime, which I think is a pretty standard assumption of most people who look at North Korea today. By the same token, as you say, U.S. policy will not, and we believe should not, consciously abandon its demand that North Korea denuclearize. So then, where does that's obviously the point where our general policy is right now, but as I said at the beginning, our report was not trying to solve the overall policy conundrum. We were trying to just make recommendations on this particular thing. And as Brent is saying, you're left with, if you're trying to address any other issue with North Korea, saying, well, can I do anything? Because am I left saying we shall not take step one on anything else until, right? So basically, the idea is we reaffirm the importance of the continued six-party talks and their adherence to this, and but then continue to say there are other initiatives we think make sense. I don't know if there's much else to say, really.
Focus on denuclearization, even privately, as the number one interest. For the current state of things, probably the primary U.S. security interest is non-proliferation. And it's counterproliferation, and it's PSI. And you can't get to a dialogue with, say, China on that if you are still standing with number one interest, denuclearization, which in North Korea is not their number one interest. Stability in North Korea is their number one interest because they need to maintain a safe and secure border and continue to remain in power in Beijing. So having that roadblock in front of you impedes any further progress on what I think is probably the largest security interest to the United States right now, which is counterproliferation.
Eric.
On the last question with regard to China and the U.S. Common end game, our discussion went like that. We see China and the U.S. not having common priorities, as one of my colleagues have said, priorities when it comes to the nuclear issue in North Korea. Stability, China, and denuclearization, U.S. And in that, if the two countries don't synchronize their priorities, then it will make it difficult for any, more especially the denuclearization issue, to be accomplished. As such, if that happens, it poses a threat to the stability of the whole region. Why? Maybe in the long run, it may trigger other countries in the nearby, in the region, to think or to start discussing the possibility of them having nuclear weapons. Then on that, if that happens, it will definitely undermine the NPT regime. Therefore, we say the synchronization of these priorities between the two countries who play a major role in that region should be a priority also.
And I think it answered your question in particular, that as Eric is implying, the although I wasn't explicit about it in the remarks, and there probably isn't as much specifically said as there could be in some of the language when we're talking about developing some of these regional agreements, we did presume that ultimately that would extend to discussions with China. And I don't know, remember how explicitly that's mentioned, but clearly on some of the, especially in the second area of regional agreements, that is our presumption. So you ask a very good question, and that's, that those discussions will have to take place. And, preliminary soundings, as you well know, have gone on without much desire on the Chinese part to talk about the issue. And one of the questions for this is, no matter how much effort you put into it, are you really going to get any significant conversation back? And what do you do if you don't? That's obviously a problem.
Just to add to the comment regarding China-U.S. relationship, maybe we need to reframe some of the issues. Like, for example, the U.S. has not been very successful engaging China on human rights, as for instance. And so instead of insisting on a conversation about human rights, which they're not interested, maybe the way to reframe the question that might be, the problem that might be helpful is to have suggest discussions as a border security issue, or and sort of bring down the level from seeming to interfere in their sovereignty to cooperation on border security and stability issue, more of a immigration, public policy, or law enforcement issue. They might be a little more receptive to having a open conversation.
All right. Just a quick closeout on the six-party talk discussion from my perspective. We had the discussion that, the six-party talks should continue as we discussed, but without necessarily an expectation that we're going to achieve desired outcomes. But nonetheless, the value of the engagement and the discussions are necessary to increase our knowledge, to increase our dialogue with the other parties. I think where we've made a policy mistake, as we've repeated often today, is the expectation that they will actually obtain a desirable outcome, which is, we conclude is unlikely.
Okay, other questions? Right here in the back.
Now, I have two questions here. I think if there are many scenarios possible in the future of North Korea, I think we should be prepared for the worst one to begin with, which is sudden collapse of North Korean regime any time in the near future, and China intervenes with the millions of armies deployed across the river to North Korea. And then what can be done about this worst scenario? That is my question. Does the United States have any plan in this situation here? And for that, I think South Korea should have its own atomic bomb. I think that's only going to be deterrent available to prevent China from moving in to North Korea. And South Korea cannot certainly lose this golden opportunity to reunify. And if South Korea loses the opportunity, it may never come back. Once North Korea becomes a colony of China, then there's no chance. That's one question. And the second one is, now there's a stalemate going on in the dialogue between North and South, because President Lee maintains no apology, no dialogue policy. And Kim Jong-il is absolutely refusing to apologize for any of his crimes. So I don't know what's the end of this stalemate. And does the United States or expert have any idea how to stop this if they really want to see some dialogue, meaningful dialogue between these two parties? That's my question. Thank
you. Okay. Okay, the group's pointing at me for that one. I think on the first one, clearly the potential for a sudden collapse was one of the scenarios that we looked at, and the issue of Chinese involvement is, as I mentioned, one of the real issues that this policy challenge is raising. It's raising right now, and it will continue to raise over time. And on the one hand, there's no reason why, persistently or in a particular crisis scenario, that Chinese involvement in a North Korea regime event needs to create any sort of a flashpoint. On the other hand, we can all imagine and have probably read the scenarios of ways in which it could create, could bring the United States, South Korea, Japan to the brink of some very serious situations with China. And at the moment, partly because, as we've talked about, China's lack of willingness to really engage the issue, and so it's not entirely our fault, but at the moment, our argument is we're not doing enough to lay the groundwork to prevent potentially very preventable moments from happening in that regard. So the China issue is definitely one of the challenges to worry about. In regard to the overall collapse, one of our arguments in some of the initiatives we'd like to take is, you know, this argument's been made forever, and, you know, as part of the basis for the Sunshine Policy and so on, but in terms of capacity building, both human and institutional, part of, if some of the initiatives we're talking about were able to go on for a period of time, part of what you're doing is laying the groundwork so that when those moments occur, even to the point, for example, of working with defector organizations in South Korea so that officials and others in North Korea, in a confusing moment, you have better opportunity to contact them, relationships have been formed, there have been contacts so that people have a better sense in the North of what to do and maybe less fear of what the next weeks and months might hold for them and that sort of thing, if that can be accomplished. So the kind of initiatives we're talking about would try to get at the risks of that kind of a moment. But the last point you make does get to the constraints that a policy like this faces in general, and also the constraints of the moment. Right now, you know, North Korea doesn't even want anything to do with the Mount Kumgang tourism business. So why are they going to want anything to do with any of the rest of this, given the, as you say, the stalemate in their relationship? There's certainly a stalemate in our relationship. And so although we don't, there's not a piece of our report that, because in a way it's sort of the broader strategy, but there does need to be a strategy to get beyond the current stalemate. And I think given the nature of our policy over the last decade or more, the subconscious assumption of the United States is it's not our job to get beyond the stalemate. You know, we have the demands on the table. When North Korea is ready, they will come to the table. But part of our argument is we have interests at stake that would be better served if we could implement some of the ideas we're talking about. And therefore, strategically, it makes sense for us to get beyond the stalemate. And it gets very challenging because in the process, some of the ideas that bubble to the surface sound like they are justifying, they are recognizing North Korea as a nuclear state. They are justifying North Korea's nuclear progress and all the rest. But to get beyond that moment, get beyond that stalemate to the point where we could be doing some of these things we're talking about and still pursuing denuclearization without sort of the grand engagement notion that's been talked about for decades would, in our idea, be promoting our interest in the context of regime futures. Now, what that strategy is to get over that stalemate, that's the subject of somebody else's panel report.
One of the features of the strategy is it's a multi-track, so that at one level, in say engagement at the six-party talks, we're addressing or maintaining the status quo in one case, statements of the intention to denuclearize on the North Korean part. Then at a more quiet, more diplomatic level, and even on economic level, we're engaging to build up those relationships so that in the uncertain future or circumstance occurs that would set back any gains on the diplomatic, economic sphere, actually don't go back to zero. We see this after every incident, crisis that North Korea instigates. So the idea is also to have a very flexible and dynamic strategy, and it's multi-track in nature. And of course, just to reiterate, there is no, I guess, sequential requirement in the bilateral relationships. This all is going on in parallel. I just wanted to stress that.
I just make a sort of a sidestep, because one of the models that we have been looking at was the German reunification as one point which could serve to some extent as an analogy, or we could look at it. And if we see that, it wasn't that the Germans waked up on one day and they were unified. So there was some preparation on that. That means that nations which are neighboring countries, or important nations like the US, important nations like Russia, which were for Germany, played a role in setting the stage, in preparing the even the people in the country. So there must be a prospectus for those people who are now in power in the country. We'll have to have a future on that. So what about the people in the countries? If you have a prospectus on that, if South Korea is prepared to have steps on that, that could be an interesting point. And to some extent, it prepares the floor, the stage, to make it more possible.
I'm going to follow up on that point real briefly. In the paper, we talk about how we both desire and fear to some extent the collapse, because then that would precipitate perhaps the change we're looking for. But a rapid collapse, or even a gradual collapse, but especially a rapid collapse, the economic impact, even in a soft landing scenario, is going to be significant. I mean, you know, arguably the German unification is a very soft landing scenario, but yet it still had a major economic impact. And one of the fears that the region has and we have is the economic impact of reunification. So as soon as we can, to the extent that we can, anything that raises the level of prosperity and the capacity and those kinds of things would mitigate against that future economic impact. Now, again, that's a controversial approach, because how do you justify investment? But in my mind, I don't see any case in which an economic collapse, induced or otherwise, is in our national interest or the region's interest.
All right, other questions? All the way in there.
Thanks. I'm Siwon Byung with the Asia Foundation. I'm wondering if, based on your study, there are preferred mechanisms for dealing specifically with the stabilization issue. Do you prioritize the U.S.-Korea bilateral or a trilateral with China, or still a multilateral framework within the existing six-party talks?
Can you define what you mean by the stabilization issue?
Well, it seems the main argument of your paper you seem to emphasize that there's too much prioritization of denuclearization, which prevents moving forward on the stabilization issue, ensuring internal stability in North Korea. And especially when it comes to tensions between the United States and China over this prioritization of stabilization and denuclearization, it seems the tensions between these two issues is what's been preventing the parties from moving forward in the six-party talks. So I'm wondering if you are suggesting that there should be a greater emphasis on stabilization, what is the framework, the dialogue framework, or the preferred dialogue framework for addressing this issue?
Okay. Well, Greg's going to have a chance. The microphone's coming if you want to bring to Greg.
To date, our approach, well, in kind of the last 8 years or so, the approach has been a multilateral approach using coercion from that six-party talk venue or other venues to try to induce change in North Korea. So it's sort of a coercion model from the outside attempting to apply leverage to the North Korean problem. The overarching part of our project was, is that working? And our answer was no, since our primary issue was a denuclearization of North Korea for the last 21 years. And in 21 years, they've developed a nuclear capability and demonstrated it. So it's clearly not worked. One of the strategies, and this is what Professor Mazar has been kind of highlighting about in the study, was to try an inside-out approach. We currently know very little about what's going on in North Korea. Folks in the room collectively have a good chunk of knowledge about what's going on in North Korea, but outside the room, that the depth of that knowledge dwindles. That's because we continue to look at North Korea like we're on the outside of a drive-in movie theater. We're peeking over the fence. So we need to actually drive the car into the drive-in. And one of the things we discussed was possibly establishing an intersection. I don't think it made the cut for the paper, but it's about changing the approach from the outside in to getting to the inside, and then better identifying social movements within North Korea so that if something like Egypt happens or something like Iran a couple of years ago, think about our informational position with the U.S. government. How much did we know about what was going on in Tehran other than the Twitters that we got? Very little. How much did we know about what was going on in Egypt? Quite a bit more. And that's because we fundamentally had a different strategy. We were engaged. We were inside as well as outside, not only trying to coerce, but attempting to promote. And that's what the papers, that's sort of the theme that runs throughout the paper and all the different policy options.
Well, I don't know that it was cut necessarily. I think it's
I have no subtlety, so I'm sorry.
It's there in the form of, you know, sort of basically the other kinds of things. I mean, one thing I would say just quickly in response to that is I wouldn't describe what we're after is stabilization. It's not the right term to use. And I wouldn't describe it as turning away from denuclearization to achieve stabilization. You know, the idea is only that our argument is just that the policy focus has been so solely on nuclear matters that we haven't given sufficient attention to other things. The idea is not to reduce not to care about nuclear denuclearization in favor of other things. And the issue is not stabilization so much as it is preparing for these regime future issues.
But just to add also, stability also can also include certain circumstances of natural disasters. And events in Japan recently and in other places over the last decade kind of bear that out. So discussions that would take into account disaster responses is another way to look at stability and maybe would be less threatening and more likely to induce the Chinese and then maybe later on the North Koreans to partake in multilateral discussions that also have a benefit to the worst case scenario of a regime collapse.
And I think another aspect of the multi-pronged approach, if you will, that we discussed is to a degree, kind of probe, you know, take a few actions, recognizing some of them aren't going to necessarily succeed or pan out in the way that we anticipate, but probe, see the reaction, learn from the reaction, gain information from the reaction to figure out perhaps another probe or adopt the approach. So again, let's take some actions, you know, over time and across a regional broad front with the intent to create potential opportunities. We don't see any opportunities right now in many respects. I mean, we're in a strategic dilemma, I argue, but we're not taking an active stance to create any opportunities, much like we did in the Soviet Union. We engaged information, we probed here and there, and we learned from that process. So, you know, anything we can do through our actions, direct or indirect, to decrease the unknowability improves our position going forward.
Next question.
And I think our paper is very aptly entitled Shifting Out of Neutral, and the current situation I think illustrates or further highlights this situation is the U.S. official position is we will first wait for inter-Korean relations to improve before we engage North Korea. Lee Myung-bak is sort of stuck in a hard place because he can't warm up to North Korea given the domestic situation in response to Cheonan and the shelling of the Yongpyeong Island. So, but privately, he have expressed his desire to re-engage North Korea, but is looking at the United States to perhaps take charge or make the initiative so that would in turn would give him political justification within Korea so that he could act and that his actions are in concert with that of the United States. So, and if that interpretation is accurate, then I think that our current inaction is further perpetuating the situation that goes to nowhere.
Okay, other questions? Right here, and then we'll go. Right here first, and then the back. We'll go here first, and then please.
Yes, thanks. It's Catherine Weathersby from SAIS. The information I get from a German colleague who's been doing capacity building for several years, almost a decade now, with North Korea, doing programs 4 or 5 times a year in third countries, and so has very close and long-standing contacts within the DPRK, is that at a certain level, in any case, of the elite there is very eager to expand relations with the United States because they are increasingly uncomfortable with their dependence on China. So they're looking for expanded ties with the U.S. in order to counterbalance their dependence on the PRC. So I wonder how you figure that sort of dance into into your approach to how we could both make use of that desire on the part of the DPRK, but also avoid getting, in the position the Soviets were in, for example, for years.
Okay. Why don't we just do one person on each now?
Okay. As far as, the real dance is that, is to try and keep the U.S. government from being like the image behind any economic or engagement. Of course, we've got the political, diplomatic that obviously will. But if that economic initiative has overly American government footprint on it, that does play right into a North Korean game of playing China against the United States, much like they did the Soviet Union off of China in the past. So you're right, that is a problem. And the big issue is to try and allow the economics, the foreign investment, to not stand in the way and actually, in some cases, entice it, but do it in a way that it is not attached to the U.S. government overtly. And the idea, the other just to also mention, is as we know, as we apply pressure on the externally to the North Koreans, the Chinese regime in Beijing has taken up the slack, pretty much acting as a pressure relief. So if we have the economic opportunities coming from the United States, both in direct investment as well as educational, of course, that's got a lot of concerns. And you can also learn about why what they want from the United States, I would also add. But if we give them that opportunity, then as the pressure's turned up externally and the North Koreans look to what they've already had, the tried and true Chinese, but they become ever increasingly dependent on, now they can look to the other doorway and they see a United States non-governmental avenue that's now available to them, with certain limitations, obviously.
Okay, next question. No.
Okay, and all the way in the back, please.
I'm Bill Newcomb, and I've got some questions about coercion. You indicated that it was more or less a U.S. policy, yet it's a multilateral policy. It's a United Nations policy. It's a bilateral policy between Japan and North Korea. It's a bilateral policy between South Korea and North Korea. Sometimes China adopts coercive measures to make North Korea behave. And so should North Korea face the moral hazard for its behavior or not? Should current coercive measures that are on the books be withdrawn to advance this other agenda? And if so, how do you think the North Koreans would respond to the withdrawal of sanctions?
I'll just take that one quickly. You're absolutely right. It is multilateral and a series of bilaterals. And in fact, in our report, and this is, gets to the sort of paradoxical nature of it, we recommend a continuation of enforcement of illicit activities of the regime, proliferation security initiatives, a whole range of things that are designed to continue to enforce against those activities where the regime is violating international standards, and you know, continued demands on denuclearization as well. The challenge, though, is that at the same time, we believe that this is a regime that is heading in a direction that poses significant geopolitical risks for the United States and its allies. And there is a separate set of initiatives, policy steps, that could potentially mitigate some of those risks. And that creates this dilemma and this set of paradoxes. None of the things that we're proposing are things that are designed as carrots or offers or if you do this, you'll get that. Sort of the classic way of conceiving behavior-based engagement toward North Korea. They're designed to achieve specific effects to promote U.S. and allied interests in the context of regime futures. And so I think the way I would answer it is to say they should face consequences for behavior of certain kinds and in certain categories. That shouldn't keep us from at the same time trying to pursue interests in other categories that may in those categories be perceived to assist their regime in certain ways if we believe on balance it promotes our interests. The challenge will be, I think, whether they will let us get away with it, whether they will accept those initiatives in those other categories at the same time as we are still cracking down on their illicit financial activities, whether we're still occasionally perhaps stopping a ship at sea that has weapons on it, that kind of thing. Obviously, the Macau Bank is an example of a time when, you know, one action brought to a halt a whole lot of other diplomatic things that were going on. And if that behavior pattern continues, we may find a situation where the kind of paradoxical proposal we're putting together will just collapse because every time we do something on the enforcement side, all of the finely tuned contacts with North Korean officials and capacity building and everything else gets turned off instantly because the regime says you have to deal with us on the same wavelength at all times and in all places. I don't know. But so that's kind of the answer is it's a regime that should face consequences, but it's also a regime that is going to have consequences because of what happens to it. And if we don't act to mitigate them, things might be worse for us than not. So, you know, I don't know a better way to answer it than that.
Yes, right here.
Thank you. Norm Hastings, State Department. Is there a humanitarian aspect to the strategy, and how might humanitarian action in North Korea produce leverage for the goals that you have here?
Anybody have a particular thought on that?
Well, on the first point, it gets back to some of the planning. I mean, that's perhaps an area where we can, one, plan for, two, perhaps engage some of the preliminary discussions with China on how we would collectively and regionally respond to a humanitarian crisis and avoid the flashpoints that may arise. Also, I think, you know, encouraging and leveraging the success that the UN has had and the World Food Program and the Food for Work Program and the World Health Organization and those kinds of things that, again, in absence of crisis, improve the humanitarian situation over time. So I think, you know, continue to encourage and support those efforts is a key. And again, that also in my mind establishes some of those relationships that can be built upon again in the event of a crisis scenario, and build upon those solid relationships that have been developed over time. Yes, much of the World Food Program food assets, you know, does have a USAID banner on them, you know, that they then incorporate when we have done that. But it's in the research that I've done on that outside of this particular session with the World Food Program, it has a UN face to it.
Right. We did not address that specific question. But, you know, actually an implication of your question that's very interesting that we did not address, and it would be, I think, in this context, an interesting one, is how could a somewhat expanded structure for humanitarian planning become the planning foundation, sort of a multilateral, basis of relationships, structures, procedures, meetings, and so on, that maybe you wouldn't even talk about it that way at the beginning, but that would be, you know, that you would be setting up, built off of the current aid structure with a concept in mind that this is the network we would then blow up into its next iteration. I don't know. But it's something we actually did not think about, but might be. Lourdes? Yeah.
Well, the first recommendation about addressing hard questions was actually prompted by our discussion about in conflict scenarios, what could we possibly think about? So when we say, factors beyond U.S. control are going to determine what happens in North Korea, and the best that we can do is look at situations in the past, historical situations, peace and conflict resolution situations, where there's a reasonable amount of information out there where we can start planning and thinking about and asking hard questions about things like humanitarian aid. Part of some of our readings and some of the expertise was about sort of lack of infrastructure. How are we going to get aid to people? So those types of questions were part of that recommendation. Now, we focus on a lot of, what are we going to do if the regime collapses? But certainly those are the other types of questions that could be added to this list of things that we haven't discussed, or at least in our conversations with experts, there were a lot of questions that we asked of them that was just responded with well, that's a good question. And that's where it stopped. And so really we think that there should be hard questions like that.
And as we consider providing food aid to North Korea, and I know that domestically some of the concerns has been diversion of the food to the military or reselling of the food, externally. And as Mike said, that the humanitarian assistance could perhaps be a foundation where, what I understand, that previously when China and South Korea provides food aid, there's no conditions attached to it. And perhaps this time around, is it possible for the U.S., China, and South Korea to coordinate food aid in such a way that it can be monitored in a standardized fashion to ensure that it gets to the targeted population, for example? So that's one idea.
Okay. Any other questions? If I can just ask a quick one. You talked about one of the hard questions was
if there's a collapse or it looks like there's about to be a collapse, one of the questions is, will the regime must end? Should the regime must end? And so I guess have the what's going on in the Middle East and North Africa and kind of the preparation, having that question asked in those situations, has that those situations kind of helped frame this question or give us a better way of answering this question as it comes to North Korea?
Well, I'll just say something quickly, and then if anybody has any reflections, it's, I don't know about anybody else in the audience, but watching what's going on in North Africa has given me very little confidence in thinking that we're going to handle the North Korea situation at all well, because the U.S. response to those situations, and, you know, none of us being in those rooms, policymakers have to respond on the fly. This is what they have to do. But look at the response, you know. Should we support them? Should we not? Does the regime need to end? You know, don't they? Are we more concerned about stability, or do we have more? All of those questions, the exact questions that will come up in a regime future scenario with North Korea. And they had no answers. And why didn't they have answers? Because they hadn't thought it through in advance. Exactly the problem in the Korea case. Except in the Korea case, it is a U.S. adversary with a million-man army, a nuclear arsenal, sitting in the middle of all of these major powers, with a country, China, across the border that may or may not send troops across to try to deal with the situation. Far more intense of a flashpoint. And exactly the same questions. Which comes back, really, it's a great question, because I think it comes back to exactly where we started, which is, if that's how we, and it, you know, again, really no disparagement to officials, because these are hard questions that popped up out of nowhere and they had to find their way through them as best they could. Understood. But now you turn around to North Korea and you say the same sort of thing could happen there. A confused situation, a variety of groups, you have to decide what to do. We really need to think that through before we get to it. And that is ultimately the message of our report. That's the kind of thinking we're trying to get started with this, whether or not any of our specific recommendations are agreed with or whatever. That's the kind of thinking we're trying to get started. That's our basic belief that in our current policy, we have not done enough to think through those issues. And we're trying to get some reasonable, good ideas out on the table to start that dialogue. And so that was our primary purpose.
All right. Are there any other questions? Well, if not, I want to thank all of you for joining us today. This is a great paper and great discussion and trying to help us think through some of these questions on possible futures and future scenarios. We'd like to see you all again tomorrow as we're hosting a program on green finance in Korea here at KEI at 10. And our next academic paper series will be on April 27th. We have Dr. Jose Luis Leon Manriquez. He's coming in to talk about comparing economic reforms in North Korea and Cuba. And then be sure to check our website for our podcasts, and some of the interviews are on the posters outside. And then lastly, please give me help me thank Dr. Mazar and the study group. Thanks, everybody.